Welcome to the Higher Ed Podcast, where we explore the latest developments and emerging trends in the world of higher education. Our podcast features in-depth discussions with the industry's leading experts, providing valuable insights and actionable advice for academic leaders and executives. From designing impactful universities and establishing strong brand identities for colleges, to delivering exceptional student services, we cover it all. Join us as we reimagine the future of higher education, one episode at a time.
Welcome back to another episode of the Higher Ed Podcast. I'm your host, Kamar DeJarnett. I'm flying solo today. We're actually recording on Good Friday. Dr. Jerry Wallace has been so generous with his time, and I really do appreciate him joining us today. Doctor, could you please introduce yourself to our audience?
Absolutely. Great to be here. Great to be invited to this podcast. Again, Dr. Jerry Wallace here. I work and serve in the greater Houston area, supporting community colleges, able to connect with building programs around male students of color. And more specifically, I'm a member of the 100 Black Men of Houston chapter of the Education and Mentoring Committees, where we work with K-12, community partners, men's health and wellness agencies, education, different spaces throughout greater Houston to support the lives of Black individuals, but all individuals in our community.
Absolutely. Now, some may say this is an obvious question, but, you know, I think I should ask, why are you so passionate about Black men in higher ed?
Well, obvious question. I just happen to be one. So, man, just over the course of my life, man, first generation college student and growing up in a small town. In a town, you know, we call Prison Town. It's a small town called Huntsville, Texas.
Okay.
And I grew up there, and there's four or five state prisons there. And I've had family members and friends who, you know, been in and out of those places. So seeing that growing up and experiencing it with friends. And then when I got to high school, I moved to a different community. And then I had a culture shift. So we moved from, you know, a small country town to a more bigger metropolitan community right out of North Houston. And, you know, it was booming. And, you know, I saw different demographics, more upper middle class families, and I had culture shock. And as I transitioned from high school going into college, again, I kept having culture shock. I kept seeing, you know, the predominantly white community be successful and the majority of African-American or Hispanic communities not be. You know, being African-American male finishing college, one of the only, you know, in my, you know, so it bothered me all the way through. And, you know, as I moved through education and I sought my degrees, I said, well, how can I get involved? And as a college student, I was involved in programs that supported, you know, Black people, our Black students, working with different groups, started a group in college. We started a program with African-American male program called AMP, you know, so I was in that. We had 100 Black men who were mentors. I was in a modeling entertainment group called Black Dynasty, joined a Christian fraternity called Gamma Phi Delta, and just got involved in different things that was around supporting Black lives. So, you know, and it just kind of led me through my career where I'm at right now.
Right. Now, outside of just the community and the culture shock from Huntsville to, you know, Houston, was there like any maybe pivotal event that kind of ushered in, you know, you just working with so many different groups?
Yeah. Absolutely. When I got to college, the first college I got to, I was at HBCU, and I didn't have the best experience I thought I was going to have. So I won't name the school. I think it's the overall the school has gotten better. But I transferred from the school and I went to the university where I attended and finished. So while I was there, I was able to see, you know, what was happening in that Black community there. And I met some mentors, some pastors at a church, and I connected with them. And then just seeing, you know, other groups on campus, I just got involved and I saw how many Black leaders were on my campus and they reached out and they wanted to mentor and we wanted to connect and build programs. It really helped just that culture shock piece quick story. When I was 17, I just remember played basketball in high school, and we had the end of year basketball party at one of my friends' houses, one of my white friends, my teammates. Okay. And I just remember driving through their neighborhood, seeing these two-story houses with gated communities.
Sure.
And we're driving in, and I'm sitting here like, where does this boy live in? Like, what is this? And, you know, going into his house, and I remember his dad opening the door, and he got food in his hand, and they all excited, like, man, go in the back. Everybody's hanging out and pool in the backyard, and the pool changing colors. And I'm like, what is this?
He said the pool changed colors.
I mean, you know, they had the light up pool, whatever. Right. You know, and I just remember there was a moment where I kind of had this epiphany. Like, it's like I was sitting in the pool and everybody's just playing and having fun. And I had this out of body moment where it's like, this is what I want. Like, this is how I want to live. Like, what do I got to do to live like this? And I realized both of his parents went to college and not just went to college. I mean, they got exceptional degrees. They moved up. His dad was a very good mentor of mine, and he did a lot of good work. His dad later on actually took me to visit the college. I wanted to play college ball, and his dad, and they put me in the car, and they said, hey, man, I got a friend at a college who's the assistant coach. And he said, hey, let's go check it out. And I was shocked. Like, okay, these white people taking me to school. But he was a good friend. And that's kind of sparked me to just do better. And then again, like I said, I go to college and I get involved.
Now that's an awesome story, man. I know I had one of my mentors in college. Guy was my dean early, and he said, look, man, I think you're pretty sharp. He said, but you got to get out of your environment. It was like your grades right now don't really reflect who you are. Like, I can tell you're distracted. And that's when I went from Penn State, one of the branch campuses, up to the big show. And all of a sudden, my grades just, you know, shot up. You know, I was able to lock in on academics. So I understand what you mean, kind of running into the right people. And I'm just kind of guiding you, just, you know, getting you into the right direction. It helps so much. That's an awesome story. So when you think about Black men in higher ed, do you think about, you know, kids, you know, students attending college, or do you also think about, you know, deans and, you know, educate, like Black male educators in college as well?
Yeah, it's both, because the education part, when you know, I'm a dean at a college. So when you get to my level, I mean, you're talking 15, 20 years in, but that's the end goal, right? We got to go all the way back to the beginning. Because if our young boys are not having a quality experience in K-12, it's highly unlikely that they'll make it to going to college or even being an administrator on a college campus. You know, if they're having difficulty in their environments and their home life, which is a big part of the struggle in K-12. I mean, we often talk about teacher retention in K-12 and principal turnover and budget and all it is. But if the teachers don't have time to actually teach, because they're dealing with the challenges or deficiencies of young males and what's happening in their personal world, you know, it's a constant battle. And if those young men are not, you know, engaged in different things, or if there are programs not in their community that support them, I mean, literally 24 hours a day, you're not going to be able to successfully have a good experience to make you want to become an educator, right? And I'm not saying it's impossible, because you do have those that say, because I went to a terrible school, I want to become a teacher, right? Or I want to become a principal or a dean at a college, et cetera. But it's very rare. So they often go after what the media and entertainment says is what's going to make me more money and what's going to make me feel great, right? And when you look at the media, when you look at, you know, athletes and entertainers, the visual says this is something that's great. Like, this makes me feel great. They look like they're having fun and they making money, right? So they equate that with what they think in their mind as a youth as a quality life, right? Which is honestly makes sense. Like, I want to make money and I want to feel good making money. That's I think common, right? But it does impact education, because you have young men who, you know, won't desire to continue their education to go into those fields that allow them to become principals or superintendents, or even at the college level, you know, becoming a tenured faculty member doing research, right? That's, you know, you have to have a literary mind to be a researcher. You have to be analytical in a way. If you want to become a dean, you're managing people. That's leadership. That's, you know, being able to have emotional and cultural intelligence when you're working with people. So those, that's the end goal, but it takes years to get there. And a lot of our young men, just through life circumstances or challenges, never make it to that point. So thus we have this continuous challenge in education.
All right. It makes sense. Man, I can't remember his name right now, but we were talking about the same topic. And this wasn't a podcast, but we were just kind of getting introduced to each other to decide if we were going to do a podcast. And he touched on a lot of the points that you just touched on in terms of, you know, will I earn the right amount of money? Does it look good? You know, is it a celebrated profession? But then he also, like you said, kind of the males are typically supposed to be the breadwinners. And it's like, okay, well, where can I make the most money? So he said that the missing ingredient to that conversation is, can the people who can actually afford to become teachers, if, you know, being a teacher is not going to generate the salary for them to provide for, you know, the household. So it makes you wonder, how do we figure this piece out? Because it's, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that you're right on point. It's really the quality of what they get and being able to understand that. Because, you know, right now, teacher salaries are going up slowly but steady, but they're going up. You know, you have high 50s to 60s, 60K. And then if you can become a principal, you're talking, you know, 85 to 100, if not more than that. Sure. Right. Then when you look at, you know, assistant superintendents or superintendents, you're talking 280,000, 200,000, 300,000, you know, so. It's not that, honestly, the finances aren't there, because if you look at any other careers, if you're starting out as an engineer with, you know, 5-6 years of college education, you're starting out at about 70K, 75K. You know, teachers aren't too far from that.
Right.
But I think the challenge that they're seeing is school is hard and, you know, personal life challenges. And they see the teachers dealing with key. And they're like, I don't want, if I got to be a teacher and deal with that, I don't want to be a teacher, right. You know, and it's discouraging because, again, I go back to the quality experience in K-12. Like, what makes me feel good? Like, how can I be a part of social networks or organizations that, number one, support my academics, but also support me socially, emotionally, culturally? And, you know, that's why I like sports. Because it gives you that, you know, you get an opportunity to compete, to learn the values of winning and losing, because you're going to win and lose in life and you got to be able to pick up and go to the next game. Right. But you also have to learn team building because you're on the team with people. You know, unless you're doing tennis and you're playing, you know, by yourself, most of sports is a team game. So you have to deal with personalities and, you know, your mentor in certain cases is the coach. So if we can provide more opportunities like that for youth in all capacities, and I don't mean sports per se, because not everybody can play sports, not everybody wants to play. But if you think about like a basketball team, you only have 12 on a basketball team. So that's a small population of students when you look at an entire class. So then we have to say, well, what other kind of programs can we create in schools? What other resources do we need to bring in? Do we need to hire staff or get community partners to come in, like the 100 Black Men, to come in and support these concepts to create a high quality experience for students, which will hopefully help retain them as they move through K-12. And again, give a quality experience. So in their mind, they're not looking at teaching as a deficit profession. They're looking at it as an opportunity to give back, to mentor, and then I can increase my salary. Like, I can do this. So it's a year's work, you know, years work of stuff to be able to do. It doesn't happen overnight. So again, when we talk about, let's say, college retention, the challenges of academic success in high school does have an impact on that. But institutions, higher ed institutions, and K-12 have to work together to be able to combat some of those challenges.
Got it. And talking about teamwork, I think that's a good segue into another one of your passions, which is academic partnerships. I'd love for you to tell me kind of how you think about academic partnerships and why you're so passionate about those.
Absolutely. So academic partnerships have to be the foundation in any type of career workforce development. An example would be if there is a industry partner that says, hey, we want to recruit college students who have these specific skills and understand these baseline foundations to work for us. What they're saying is you need to be teaching them this particular framework. So they would tell that to the higher ed institution, but then the higher ed institution has to go back to the local ISD and say, hey, we need kids who are already prepared or who have this academic foundation so they can come to us. We can equip them to go into the industry. But if the industry, the higher ed institution, and K-12 are not sitting at the table together and creating strategic academic partnerships that ultimately impact workforce development, you're going to have a recession like we've never seen before in our country. And I say that because if you look at the 1929-1930 Depression, I'm not by all means an expert on this, but what I understand is that you had a huge flux of immigrants coming into America. You had, you know, World War One that had happened 10, 15 years earlier, and you have all of these people trying to escape Europe, and they're coming to America in boatloads, trying to find jobs. And America is this land of the free, all of this kind of stuff, right? But they're coming over with skills that are not proficient for what's needed. And there's so many people and not enough jobs. So the economy collapsed. Fast forward 100 years to present day. You have a recession in 2008, almost the exact same thing. But in a sense, you have a lot of jobs, but you don't have enough highly qualified people to fill those jobs. So if we look at in this present day, 2024, you could almost have that same thing happen again. You could have all these jobs, especially new jobs with AI and technology and all these things that have never existed in world history. Right. And the pandemic sped us up, right? So you have a baby boomer generation who are retiring, leaving jobs. Then you have new jobs that have never existed. So you have a huge population of people who need to work, but they are unqualified. So if you don't have quality people, you're going to have an economic collapse. And economists can probably talk about that in way more depth than I can. But I go back to your question of academic partnership. If the industry partners are not connecting with higher ed and not connecting with K-12, and they're not sitting down and really strategically, I don't just mean a meeting. I mean, strategic partnerships where they're investing funds, resources, personnel, staff, and they're being intentional, especially around minorities, people of color, African-American, Hispanic. If you're not doing that, we are setting ourselves up for a collapse.
Now, are you seeing resistance to this, or are you also really trying to drive this and make this happen, at least in your area?
I'm definitely trying to drive and make it happen. I think some institutions are really working and trying to do a good job, but I think several other institutions are lacking the cultural competence piece. They have individuals who may work in higher ed or individuals who may work in K-12, and they don't really understand how to really create programming that, again, meet the social needs of the students. Because again, if you're talking about young people, they want to feel engaged, they want to feel empowered, they want to have this sense of belonging. So oftentimes we have people who are in different generations creating programs for students. And if they're not including, you know, the technical aspect of it, you're not going to get their attention. And you may have great intentions, but the outcome is not going to be great because the students are not engaged, right? This generation, you can't stand up in front of a kid and lecture them all day. That's not going to work, right? You got to put some type of technology in their space to allow them or to equip them to transition to whatever the career field. And you have to do that in a strategic way. You have to create a brand. And again, I just go back to the sports model. kids feel great being in sports because they all have on a jersey or a uniform, or they get to get on the bus together. They get to go to special events and they feel a part of this elite, prestigious group or club. And then in most cases, the sports athletes have tutors. They have academic components that keep them in line academically so they can continue to compete. But it's the same for like a debate team or a speech club or a chess club or the Honors Academy. These are all frameworks that allow students to be successful. So we just have to do a better job of having some cultural intelligence also around what works for specific students. So if we're talking about African-American males, Black males, what works, you know, for them may not work for our white students, may not work for our Hispanic or our Asian students. So we have to know, how do we create programs that support our Black students, but also allow them to connect with K-12, higher ed, and industry to be successful. Not getting too much pushback, I would say, but I'm seeing that institutions don't know how to do it. And it delays in the process of creating successful programming, and it takes time. So if they get discouraged, or if the numbers aren't moving fast enough for them, then the institutions give up on it. Oh, this isn't working. We're going to stop. Well, this took years for us to get into these challenges, and it's going to take years for you to get out of it. So,
yeah, you also mentioned the pandemic kind of accelerated this. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit more in terms of how you think that pandemic accelerated it?
Absolutely. So during the pandemic, you have youth who no longer have in-person interaction. So they're not interacting with their peers. They're not interacting with teachers in an in-person environment. They're not going outside to play. They're not competing in sports. All the type of things that build emotional intelligence, or that builds this sense of drive or commitment, or even it builds the, you know, just being able to sit with a tutor in person. It builds communication skills. You lost that during the pandemic. You teachers didn't have an opportunity to see what challenges or learning challenges a student may have, because you couldn't see it in the classroom. You couldn't observe the student in a day-to-day framework. So, however, technology sped up during the pandemic, yep. Right? So now you have all these virtual meetings like what we're doing, and you have technology, AI starts kicking in, and all these different things were created because the world saw that we have to have multiple means to communicate in order to consistently move our world forward. If we don't, then we're going to have a world collapse. So there were pros and cons that came out of the pandemic. But what it did was, is what we have to make sure that we do is, because of the technology that was built or established or created during the pandemic, we have to make sure that our youth are prepared to use that technology, that they have resilience, that they have the academic creativity to utilize it. Because if they don't know how to effectively communicate, if they don't know how to have critical thinking or have person-to-person interaction, I've seen so many challenges where you got cyberbullying now with kids. You have kids who have emotional anxiety or depression because, you know, my girlfriend broke up with me on social media and I'm distraught because of it, right? You know, being in person, it kind of helps you build those in-person interactions where you're not as, you don't have as much of those challenges or those feelings. So when you talk about people who get into the workplace, youth who now become adults, how are they mitigating their work environment? How are they having appropriate relationships in the workspace or in their community if they only interact in a virtual environment, right? So again, there were definitely pros and cons to the pandemic. And we really have to work with our youth to help them navigate their emotions and their feelings so they can be highly qualified workers or individuals in industry to lead us to the future.
No, and it seems like you got a little bit of a different take on AI as well. It doesn't seem like you're super concerned about AI taking jobs, but you also see that AI is most likely going to create a lot more jobs and opportunities. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your insight there, because some people are, you know, they're kind of terrified.
Yeah, I you watch all these movies, right, and the Terminator and, right, and all of this stuff, and a lot of AI movies is coming out. It's a good movie came out, man, just recently, not too long ago, with Denzel Washington's son. He played this movie, and the kid in the movie is like a person, but it's a computer, you know, it's like, yeah, a cyborg, and all these kind of movies, right? So I think, you know, those things think that, you know, we see that visually. We think that AI is going to destroy who we are and what we built. But I'll use this example. When the wheel was invented, the wheel did not take jobs away from us. It actually equipped us to do more things, right? When we domesticated animals and we started using horses and oxen to pull wagons, it allowed us to irrigate. It allowed us to build agriculture a lot quicker, right, than us pushing the plow, right? When you think about those technologies, when you think about the industrial age, when we built trains, it allowed us to move goods from one side of the country to the next in a lot faster than somebody on a horse and buggy could get it. So you see these booms that happen in human history that you think take jobs away, but it actually gives us more time back. It allows us to be more efficient in what we do, more effective, more productive in what we do. And it speeds up our economy. It speeds up opportunity. It moves us. When the internet came out, you know, we're old enough to remember dial up and AOL and all of this. But everybody said Y2K in 2000, the machines were going to take over in 2000, right? You know, and the internet, Google, right, YouTube, all these things now are created. Instagram, all of this, Facebook, these guys are billionaires who created Facebook, right? I remember MySpace and Black Planet and all this stuff, right? But people said it's going to take over, right? We're not going to have jobs. What I have seen is, and if you look at human history, you'll see anytime we come out with some major new technology, right, some innovation that allows us to move forward, we move forward by leaps and bounds than the previous generation did. And I think AI is going to allow us to do that. I think it's going to allow us to be more efficient and more effective in what we do. I think it's going to give families time back, because people are not spending time with their families anymore because they got to work so hard, so long, so many hours. And, you know, they're not spending time with their family. Our lifespan, you know, is not as, you know, we want to increase our lifespan. People want to live to be 80, 90, 100 years old, right? Well, if I got an AI watch on that's telling me how to measure my blood pressure and all this kind of stuff and get my steps in, and I got a watch that can tell me how to do that, that's AI, right? Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm excited to see what it can do. I don't think it's going to replace human beings. I think that it will allow us to be more effective and efficient. Now, there are some jobs that we may lose, but as many jobs as we lose, we're going to create probably twice as more in a different capacity that we've never seen. And last thing I'll say on that is that I think we're also going to have more global interactions as well, where we're going to interact with people all across the world in a more expedited way, a more efficient way. So you're going to see more global interactions, especially, I taught a class where I connected with a faculty who was in another country, and we were in a different time zone, and I wanted to invite them in as a speaker. So we had class and we zoomed them in, and over there it was, you know, 11:30 at night, you know, right, and we zoomed them in, and just being able to do that, I think it's going to propel us forward.
Absolutely. The last few weeks, I've done a podcast with a fellow who was in British Columbia. Another one, a buddy of mine, Darren Thompson. We do kind of the AI version of this podcast. He was in Phoenix. And the other fellow that was on was in Tokyo. So and then we had the CEO of Darren's company that he's working with. And I believe he was in Pakistan. So And this is literally over the last couple of weeks. So like you said, did I know the Tokyo one, I had to be at the office at I was at 7 at night to get, kind of connect with his time zone. So yeah, it's making the world a lot smaller. I think you nailed that one. Lastly, I just, I've heard you talk about strategic planning a lot. And, I know it's another passion. If you could maybe just give me a tad bit of insight into that and we'll wrap up.
Yeah. Strategic planning has to come from long range vision plan. You have to look 5-7 years ahead, maybe even 10 years ahead. And you have to say, well, this is the ultimate goal. In 7 years, this is where we want to be. Then you take that overall vision and you say, okay, now what do we need to do each year to get there? Then you have to say, well, what do we have to do each month to get to that year, each week to get to that month, each day to get to that week, right? You got to go that granular with it. And you don't want to create too many goals. You want to keep it to possibly 3 to 7 or 3 to 5 goals that you can actually complete. And you may want to complete those goals. If it's over a 7-year span, you may say, well, let's complete these 3 goals by the 2nd year. In the next 2 years, we'll complete these other 3, et cetera. And you have to understand that it takes time, that you may have to adjust in what you do. You're going to have to review your data. You're going to have to look and see what increments that you did improve upon. And oftentimes we look at the deficit and say, well, this is we didn't do so well here, but you got to make sure to look at what you did do well, what did improve. And you have to continuously let your teams know what the vision is. You got to have moments where you celebrate that win. You have to say, man, thank you guys. You guys are doing a good job. You know, teachers, you're doing great, or community, we're doing great. And you have to celebrate that win. Bring those youth in and celebrate that win. And that keeps you along the goal. You have to consistently remind people what the goal is. But strategic planning takes a variety of different people. It takes, having collaboration. It takes patience. It takes really listening to the needs of the community, the community's needs, and then the needs of the industry. If you can, because they're on two ends of the spectrum. So the way I look at it is you have the community on one end, industry on the other end, and you have K-12 and higher education in the middle. Because the community is going to tell you the deficits that they face. Industry is the end goal. They're going to tell you what we need to fill jobs and to keep our economy going. But if you don't know what's happening in the community's challenges transition into K-12. Kids are having problems not because of K-12, because of what's happening in their personal lives, in their homes. So if we collectively as a group don't work on a strategic plan to say, well, what needs do we need to support in the community and collaborate with the various organizations that meet those needs, then we can successfully move our strategic plan forward. I'll use an example. Say you want to reduce recidivism or reduce young men in the prison or juvenile justice system. Okay, if I want to get this group of young men into workforce, and I know that if they have a certain felony, they can't get this job. If young men cannot be school teachers or can't do this if they have certain felonies or certain things because they can't pass the state exam or they can't qualify for it. Okay, well, if I need to get more Black male teachers in the classroom, which is industry or which is a job, what do I need to do going all the way back to the community to make sure that they have a quality experience in the community that don't land them in jail? Right. So I have to have those activities in the community and I got to connect with those agencies that do those things. I have to do the same thing in the K-12 system, in the higher ed system. So that way, at each stage of that young man's life, as he matures, there is a program or an activity or an organization that exists, and they all collaborate to make sure that that young man does not get involved in gang life, drug life, and a violent life or any other life that lands him in prison, right? And those agencies have to work together. They have to sit at the table and they have to build a strategic plan. They got to put resources in and they got to stick to it. And that's hard because you also have turnover in agency. You know, the CEO is here today and that person is no longer here. President is gone, or the principal got laid off, or superintendent's gone, et cetera. But somebody or some agencies really have to sit down to build strategic planning to really impact our economy. It can be done. It takes some work, but I think it can be done.
I can't think of a better place to end it than right there. Dr. Wallace, really appreciate you. If you got a LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, let our audience know where they could, contact you, connect with you, and maybe drop us a little nugget on 100 Black Men and kind of what that's all about.
Absolutely. So let me talk about 100 Black Men. I'll let you know how you guys can connect. So 100 Black Men is a national organization that was founded in 1963. The Houston chapter was founded in 1994. And what we do is we work to create opportunities for our young Black men in our communities and try to help them persist in various stages of life. So we solve challenges with whether it's economic empowerment, health and wellness and fitness for men. We solve challenges in education and in mentoring. So we have different components that support our community. We have what we call Collegiate 100, which are college students. Several of them attend certain HBCUs or local colleges. I'll just say in my area, we have Texas Southern University, the University of Houston, and Prairie View A&M. We have Collegiate 100 students who are on those campuses. Then we have Emerging 100, which are men. Collegiate 100 is for young men and young women. Let me say that. Then we have Emerging 100, which is for males who recently finished college up to the age of about 34. And they do different programming and interact with the younger generation. And then we have the 100, which is men who are typically seasoned men in their profession, who are roughly over the age of 35 or so. And they're seasoned in their profession and they give back to the community. But we partner with K-12. We partner with industries, health, fitness, wellness, and all different kind of communities and industry partners to support the community overall.
Thank you, Froze. I see you coming back.
Yeah, my technology, my computer shut down on me. Don't know what that is, but we talk about AI. I got my phone with me, so we good. So let me just finish that your statement. So we're actually hosting our research institute on Saturday here in Houston, March 30th. For the state of the Black man, child, and education. So that's something that we're doing here in the Houston chapter. Nice. So to connect with me, best way to connect with me is look up drjerrywallace.com. So you'll see my website there. That's a good way to connect with me. I have information on there about who I am, what I do, and other individuals I partner with. So that's drjerrywallace.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn. So you just search me there and you'll see me on LinkedIn. Those are the two best places that I most often check to connect with me. And I'm always, a call or a text or email away to just kind of build communities and work with others in a variety of spaces.
Awesome, man. I really appreciate you sitting down with us today. Awesome podcast. Great insight. Enjoy the weekend, man, with your family.
You as well, man. I really appreciate it. I want to highlight you for what you're doing, man. Keep up the good work. I think you're doing great work in what you do, and I'm excited to see where you guys are going forward.
Awesome. I'll let you know as soon as this goes out.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care, man. Good luck.
All right. Good deal.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Higher Ed Podcast. To learn more about the topics covered in this episode, please visit engine.systems. Be sure to join us again next week and every week thereafter for more cutting-edge insights and practical advice to help you stay ahead in the dynamic world of higher education.